Hi, welcome to Premier Unbelievable. I'm Luke Martin, and today my guest is Amy Scott Robinson. She is a writer, a storyteller, and a poet. We had a fascinating conversation about Christianity and the arts, metaphor, cultural changes, and she even told us a really moving story. I think you're going to love it. Enjoy. Amy, welcome to the show. Amy, you are a storyteller and a poet and a writer, and you're also a Christian. Do you want to tell us how you combine those two, what you see as a relationship between Christianity and the arts?
Yeah, I think for me they've always been woven together, those things. I'm definitely a child of Narnia. I was brought up as, I'm a cradle Anglican, was brought up in the church, and I think I was brought up knowing rhythm and knowing language from a really early age, just because of singing hymns and reciting the creed. And the combination of music and language, that's something that really helps things stick in the memory and story as well.
So I think a lot of us will know what you mean when you talk about rhythm in music, but I think you're talking about rhythm in language as well. Do you want to expand upon that?
Yes, but I mean both probably as well. I just mentioned reciting the creed, and then I thought, well, I can still get through the creed so long as I'm chanting it to the exact chant that we used to do in my childhood church, and otherwise I would probably trip up halfway through. But even that, I mean, chanting is, that goes to the rhythm of language, doesn't it?
So if somebody was to say, like, I don't see the relevance of the arts to the Christian faith, I know people who say that, what would you say to someone who says, who objects in that way?
I would say, but they live in the same place. Faith and the arts live in your imagination. They live in what you can create in your mind. And that's not to say that faith is fake because you're making it up. That's to say that all that you draw to mind and that affects your heart is in the seat of imagination. It is exactly also where it's the same muscle that responds to poetry and that explores things with a story. I think it's all the same bit of you.
That's interesting. So a lot of what we do in Premier is sort of apologetic. So let's flesh out this idea of you're not making it up. I think when I was a kid, yeah, I used to think stories, you're making stuff up. What relevance does that have to do with understanding reality? But yeah, I've grown in that. How could you reconcile that? I know C.S. Lewis obviously talked about Christianity as the true myth.
Yeah, that's right. So C.S. Lewis saw all myth as pointing towards Christianity as the one true myth, that they all came together in the story of the gospel. And that's definitely, I mean, that's absolutely something I can see where he got that from. And I think I believe it myself. Yes, because there's a shape of story that follows the gospel. But I think it goes deeper than that. I think I'm more of a G.K. Chesterton person when it comes to theories of faith and story. And he wrote sort of an essay, it's actually a chapter of his book Orthodoxy, called The Ethics of Elfland. And he talks about the whole way that you deal with truth and what truth really is, and our expectations of the world, and how even those are seated more in fairy tale than in reality.
Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so he says, for example, he questions why we believe anything. He questions why we believe the laws of the world. There's this lovely bit in the essay where he's saying law is not really a word used in fairy tale, but a scientist will think that it's a law that a chicken comes from an egg. But he says there's no more connection between an egg and a chicken than there is between a bear and a prince. In fact, he says there might be more connection between the bear and the prince because princes can behave in bear-like ways, but you've never seen an egg behave like a chicken. So he's sort of questioning the whole logic of the world around us, and I think he's encouraging the approach of just looking at the world with the wonder of a child and saying that we don't know. Well, let's question the reason for anything happening, or let's question nothing. Because, of course, in a fairy tale, nothing is questioned at all. in a fairy tale if somebody says, you know, there's this bit in the middle of a story where a fairy tale will often interrupt itself to say, of course, in this country, this is how things were done. And then, you know, that's the logical that leads to the next thing. Of course, in this country, whenever the king died, he would send his elephant out into the street and the elephant would kneel before somebody and then they would make that person the next king. And so our hero became the king. You know, and you read that in the fairy tale, you don't question it at all. Fine. That's what happens in the fairy tale. And I think Chesterton is saying, to him, the world is like that. He's saying what he learned in the nursery, that's still how he approaches the world. Why is there a reason for anything? We should see everything with wonder. A chicken comes out of an egg. Eggs are connected somehow to flight. Why should they be?
Yeah, yeah. I'm on board with that. I'm just thinking if somebody's thinking this is just going to lead us to sort of superstitious thinking. You know, we need to be logical. We need to be scientific. Once we start believing in fairy tales, or we're going to end up thinking all sorts of things. You know, we got to focus on reality, on the truth. Like, yeah, I'm sort of pushing the point a bit, but how might you push back?
Fairy tales have their own logic. They do have a logic, and it's the same as the logic of God. I think that's my central theory when it comes to fairy tales, that the logic of the kingdom, the law of the kingdom of God, is the same as the lore, L-O-R-E, that we find in a fairy tale. So there's this bit of Proverbs. There's this little bit of Proverbs in chapter 30 where it says, there are three things that make the earth tremble, and under four things it cannot stand up. And those things are a servant who becomes a king, a fool who is filled with food, a woman, an unloved woman when she gets a husband, and a maidservant who displaces her mistress. So you look at those four things and you think, so why, in what sense is the earth trembling under those four things? And does the writer of Proverbs mean that if a servant becomes king, he won't know what to do? Or if a fool is filled with food, it's somehow undeserved, and so, you know, there's anarchy, the society has broken down. But then you look at the promises, and you know, through the Old Testament, and then particularly in the New Testament, we have the Magnificat and we have the Beatitudes, and that's exactly what's happening there. It's this upside downing of things. The rich are sent empty away, the poor are filled with food. And yet all of those scenarios, those four scenarios, they're just the plots of a million folk tales. The maidservant replacing with the unloved woman getting married, isn't that just Cinderella and 156 other folk tales? So they have this in common, that they don't contain the expectations of the world. They don't contain the logic of the world. A Christian faith isn't the logic of the world. It's not following the logic of the world. It's following the logic of God's kingdom, and that's different. It looks different. So we'll actually be closer to the logic of God's kingdom when we've read a fairy tale than we will when we've read a book of science.
And I know you're more of a Chesterton fan than Lewis. When Lewis talks about this idea of the true myth, I mean, I read recently he said that if he was just to choose his favorite myths, he would go third place the Greeks, second place the Irish, and first place the Northern myths. So myth, the Christian myth in itself isn't what really attracted him, but it's the ideas that he's finding in these other myths then brought into historical reality in the person of Jesus Christ. Do you want to speak to that idea?
Yeah, that's right. He shared the love of the Northern myths, the Norse myths, with Tolkien, didn't he? And they created worlds together because of it. And it's really interesting that he's put Greek at the bottom there, because I think Greek myth diagnoses the problem and doesn't offer a solution. So I don't know if I've seen Hades Town. I've seen Hades Town. It's amazing. It's a retelling of the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice.
Okay.
And in that myth, Orpheus, who sings beautifully, I think he was mothered by a muse, and so he has something of this divine artistry in him and can almost bring things to life, but almost is the important word there. And he falls in love with Eurydice and marries her, and Eurydice is bitten by a snake and she dies. So she's taken down into the underworld. Orpheus follows her down into the underworld because he is so determined that he can bring her back. And Hades, the king of the underworld, says, yes, all right, you can bring her up, but you mustn't
turn and look
at her. You have to walk up. You can walk up singing and she will follow you, but you have to trust that she's there and you mustn't turn around. Well, of course, he turns around. There's
just
a moment.
The
I mean, I don't want to give spoilers for what is an incredibly good musical, but I've never heard an entire theatre sobbing before. It's immensely powerful, the moment at which, and you know he's going to do it. And you sort of, why does that affect us so much? Mm. It's because it's the truth of humanity.
Mm.
It's because we know what the problem is, and we know we can't solve it. And we tell this myth about how death is final. How of course she's lost forever. Of course you can't bring her back. It doesn't matter how magical your singing is. And that's deeply affecting. But the Greek myths stop there.
That's really interesting. And actually, it's funny you mentioned, because Lewis, he also does something else with that myth, where he says it's also like the message you're trying to communicate in myths and stories, that you're as soon as you turn around and look it in the eye, you lose it. There's something about making the message of the stories too explicit. It's, you know, it's like if you have to explain a joke too much, you lose the meaning of it. So yeah, that's powerful. So the Greek myths don't offer a solution. Yeah,
yes, but they diagnose the human problem.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's so much we could say about this here. I mean, some people will say I'm on board with this. I've heard people say this to me. I'm on board with this, but and say for Christians, they'll say I'm on board with this, but how do I persuade my pastor to get on board with the idea that the arts have a value? If you had some skeptical pastors in front of you, how would you make that case?
Oh, I think I'd have to tell them a story.
Yeah, right.
Or two or three or four. I mean, if you don't have that connection, if you're not having that experience when you interact with the arts, because that's the place to start, right? To see that there is a response in us that comes from a similar place or the same place as our response when we hear the gospel.
And what if, so I guess there's going to be two options. One is these people just don't have responses to the arts. They hear some poetry and they does nothing for them. Or they do have a response, but they don't understand how it can relate to the faith that they preach about.
Or they don't
Sundays.
Trust it. They know that response has come from their imagination. They know that they have been moved by an outside thing. Mm. And that's not trustworthy for a logical person. They want to know that what they're thinking is correct. And they've maybe forgotten how to find truth in anything that they feel. So something that produces feeling becomes untrustworthy. But then you've disconnected your feeling from your faith.
Darwin said in his later life that, you know, when he was young, he used to enjoy poetry and music, but he said his brain's become like a machine. And he tries to read some poetry or listen to some music and he can't get any pleasure from it. I mean, do you come across people in your work that they're talking in a very, say, scientific, logical way, but you feel that it would just benefit their soul to sit down and read a story or listen to music?
Sometimes I do. I think my husband is probably one of them, actually. He's a very logical person. Every now and then he'll say to me, why did that make me cry? Why did that poem? What is it about this? He wants to know. He's actually a very faithful person. He's a Christian. He's not having to. But it's that response is interesting because it's Frederick Buechner said, always pay attention to unbidden tears because that's a sign of the Holy Spirit working. And I really believe, I really think if something makes you cry, to stop and say, why? That's a really good question to be asking. What is it about this thing? that is so close to God's kingdom that it's brought up this longing in me. And that C.S. Lewis talked about as well, that surprised by joy, right, that sense of sudden longing, homesickness for a home that we've never known.
Yes, yes. The desire for something that is more satisfying than the satisfaction of any other desires. Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting idea in itself, this idea that tears, because some people think of religious experiences as, you know, something that a monk has and living in a cave in medieval times or something like that, or it's something that happens in a room with loads of bright lights and everything. But just the idea of being brought to tears by a piece of art or whatever else, that itself could be the Holy Spirit working. That's a real bringing together of grace and nature. If someone pushed back and says, but that's over-spiritualizing it, we can just give psychological explanations for why people are brought to tears. There's no need to bring spirituality into it. How would you respond to that?
Are we not humans? Do we not have the facilities for these things for a reason? I just don't see the sense in leaving half of what it is to be a human behind in order to approach these big questions of life and faith. I think you have to bring your whole self to it.
Art, a lot of people make art. Some people put, I guess, a Christian label onto the art. Say, this is Christian art. Do you think about that? How do you navigate that? Do you see what you're doing when you're telling stories as like Christian art or is it just art?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question for me as a storyteller, because I do end up telling stories from other cultures. And sometimes I have to be quite sensitive about that. Or sometimes I'll look at a story and think, you know, I'm really not going to tell this one. This is a great story, but I'm going to leave it to one side because it doesn't belong to me as a Christian. And others I look at and I think, well, I'm reading this as a Christian, and therefore it's resonating for me with the kingdom, and I want to tell it in that way, and I'm going to tell it in that way. I think storytelling generally, is always this unique experience where the storyteller is communicating with the audience, and together they are creating a story. And it's an ancient story, but it's new every single time because it depends on that audience, that telling, that moment, the memories, the experiences of the people who are listening and of the storyteller all come together to create a new thing. So it's not like reading a book, performing a story. It's not like having it written down. It's more like if you stand by a river and you look into the river and the water is flowing past, you can say, I am standing on the banks of the River Cam. This is the River Cam. It's been so for a long time. But as you look into the water, the actual river, what is the river? the water going past you is changing all the time. So it's both this solid ancient thing, a story, and this thing that is new with every moment that you look at it. If you've put it in a book, it's more like taking a photograph of the river. This is what it looked like at this exact moment at this time. Or, you know, you might have taken chemical samples of the river. At this exact moment in time, this is what the River Cam was and how it looked. So if you have a book like the Grimm's Fairy Tales, this is how these folk tales looked in the year 18, whatever it was, when they wrote them down. But a story is constantly moving and changing. I've forgotten the original question.
It was something about whether the Christian label needs to be put on the art, but I loved your response.
So because I'm telling the story as a Christian, it has to make it Christian art. I can't help it. That's who I am. I'm bringing all of myself to the story. Even if my audience who are listening to me aren't Christian, that it's still what we're creating together. It is what it is. And that's what the story is in that moment. And it might not be the next time that somebody tells it.
There's another great passage from Lewis's essay on stories where people ask him about the Narnia books and they say, you know, did you think, how am I going to explain the atonement or creation or anything? He says, no.
I saw a picture of a fawn.
Yeah. and then the image of the lion. And I thought that was just wonderful. Do you want to speak to that? We have a sense of what he's communicating there, but what's your explanation?
Yeah, that he, I mean, people write and tell stories in different ways, don't they? I love that he just saw a picture of a fawn and wondered what it was. It's almost as if he himself wandered into Narnia, met Mr. Tumnus, got talking, and the whole world grew around him. And I would love to be able to do that as an author. It's really rare for me to be able to do that. I tend to have a story because it exists, and then to take that and discover what it means for me and change it and retell it. That's my art as a storyteller rather than an author.
So you're starting with the story and then moving to the meaning.
Yes, yeah. But I'm not thinking, how can I make this story have a Christian meaning? Uh-huh. I'm not thinking, how can I communicate this moral? I don't like putting morals on the ends of stories.
Uh-huh.
I prefer people to get what they get from the story.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, like C.S. Lewis, I'm not starting at the end. I'm not starting thinking, how can I communicate this specific right. thing to children? And one of the frustrating parts of my job is that's often what I'm asked to do.
Yeah.
The school will have me and they'll say, well, this is our value for this term, or this is our, you know, I would like stories that speak to this, or we'd like you to retell, you know, this parable, which is even worse. We'd like you to retell this parable of Jesus to mean, you know, to mean this thing, to have this moral. And that, I have to say, well, that's not what parables are for a start.
Mm.
I can't do that.
Yeah, it ties into this idea, you know, you just said about Buckner's idea that brought to tears is the Holy Spirit. I mean, in a sense, for Lewis, as somebody who is communing with God, in relationship with God, you know, the Holy Spirit can be at work in his imagination without him setting down explicitly to say this is the Christian story. And it reminds me of Flannery O'Connor's comment. She's asked, you know, often what's the theme of her story. She's like, no, you can't take the theme out of the story. You've just got to experience it. Mm. And that's what does the
just as you were saying about turning around and looking it full in the face, and then you're going to lose it. It's more like a tapestry that has this fine golden thread of truth running through it. And you can't, you know, if you pull the thread out to inspect it more closely, the whole thing will just fall apart and you'll lose it all. And you have to stand back from it, see the whole piece of art, and then the thread will catch the light.
And if you do that, then you understand, you're able to understand reality better, not through just propositional language, but you can see what, say, courage looks like. So I could say, the courage is blah, blah, blah. But then if you see it in a story, sort of you understand what courage can mean. And can that, what about the moral transformation that stories can have on us, the effect that they can have on us as we see these figures and stories? We then want to use them as examples for our own lives?
Yes, perhaps we do. But again, I think that we more often just see in stories what's already in us. And if something in a story is too outside of our experience or too far ahead of where we are, it simply won't resonate with us in the same way. I think for a story to be really effective, it's going to meet us and speak to us to a particular question of the soul in that moment. Mm. And I've had stories do that for me suddenly after telling them for many years. It's come to so,
you,
yes.
You're just it's like sort of, you've been telling it for years, but then you get insight into what it's trying to communicate.
That's one way of putting it, but the story isn't trying to communicate anything necessarily. It's that something has happened in me that I recognize now in the story, and then the story can take me to that next stage, or even just help me to see what it is that has changed.
Mm-hmm. So just to push that point, mm-hmm. I mean, so the story, I guess Narnia, Lewis doesn't set out to explain the atonement, but then once he's written it, I guess it is communicating ideas about creation and atonement. Or what do you think?
I wonder with C.S. Lewis at what point he realized what the story was going to be and began to construct it around that. There must have been a point as he explored. I wonder whether it was when he in his imagination met Aslan and worked out who that was. Because after that, he must have had to treat Aslan with the respect, knowing that he's Jesus. that there must have been, I mean, I'd love to sit C.S. Lewis down here and ask him if that's the case, because it seems to me that he couldn't have constructed the entire thing and then sort of thought, oh, look at that. There must have been a point when he realized what was happening, what it was becoming and turning into.
Fascinating. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few minutes.
We need to take a short break. Make sure you're following us on social media. That's at UnbelievableFE on X and at Premier Unbelievable on Instagram, Facebook, and on YouTube if you're watching rather than just listening. And if you're enjoying this new show, do leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back after a short break.
So, Amy, tell us about how you got into this world, the world of faith and the arts.
Well, I have been a storyteller forever. I used to sit underneath the dining room table at home when I was little and tell my soft toy stories. I've probably been a poet for as long as anything, because I still have the first poem that I wrote when I was about five. So I grew up playing with language and loving to write it down and loving to tell stories. I studied English. I went to Cambridge and I wrote a musical there. I did get a degree as well, but I wrote a musical there in my second year. It was called Dance to My Tune. And it was sort of an allegory. It had all these fairy tale, these are nursery rhyme characters in it. And it had the governess who was telling the story, and she became this kind of Christ figure, and she had to die. It was really from Sheldon Van Auken's, Severe Mercy, when they have a conversation about the Trinity, and he says the best way of describing the Trinity is to think of an author who writes themselves into their book, and that idea had fascinated me for a bit, so I made it into a musical. My husband tells me it was heretical, but, you know. I had a go, and that was good fun. So I suppose that was really my first foray. There was an organisation in Cambridge called the Christian Musicals Society, so I joined that and did a few more, and I wrote a May Week show as well. And then as I was leaving university, I didn't know what to do with myself, and I was about to get married, so I panicked. So I became a primary school teacher. And I was an incredibly bad primary school teacher.
Why were you bad? I'm sure you weren't.
So long as I was in front of the children telling a story, I was absolutely fine. Couldn't teach any other subjects, couldn't keep my paperwork in order, couldn't keep my class quiet unless I was telling them a story. But I used to tell stories in assemblies, and afterwards the teachers would come up to me and say, how did you do that? How did you hold their attention? How did you keep all that in your head? And I began to realise that perhaps that's a skill that not everybody has. That was something that I was, that was the thing that came most naturally to me about teaching, and everything else was awful. Then I went to Spring Harvest and watched Bob Hartman telling a story, and had a moment of epiphany. I just thought, I want to be up there doing that. Didn't know that was a thing before. So I approached him afterwards and said, how do you get to do what you do? And he was lovely to me and took me under his wing. And I phoned a friend and said, I want to get out of teaching and become a professional storyteller. Are you with me? And he said yes. So we began this company called Snail Tales, and that ran for about 10 years, and we called ourselves Storytellers in Education. And we were very much learning on the job. At first, we were more of a sort of theatre company duo. We had lots of props that we carted around in a van. We had puppets. I learned ventriloquism because we were sort of throwing everything at it and playing around with it and not knowing what would stick. And gradually that became much more of a traditional storytelling. We go in without anything. We have no props, no scenery, no background. We tell the story. We ask the audience to join us. So that's what I still do now. In the middle of all of that, I started doing bits of writing. So I started writing for Scripture Union, and they had a thing called Light for the Lectionary in those days before it all went online. And that was kind of all age service plans. So I did that for a bit, and then eventually wrote my first book. Was actually about using puppets in church, because that was a thing that I did. And a publisher said, can you write this book? And I said, well, yes, you probably need me to ask some people to help, because I actually only know ventriloquism. And the story, the book that I really want to write would be about storytelling. So he said, well, do that one next. And that's how I started writing books.
brilliant. And you've written like over 10.
Yes, I think I've written maybe 13 or 14, 13 or 14. But most of them are very short.
The best type of books. Brilliant. Well, that's fascinating. And do you know, earlier you mentioned this story that you've told how many times, loads of times, mm-hmm. throughout your working life, and that it just hit you recently or after having told it many times. I want to go back to it. You might put you on the spot, but how do you feel about telling that story?
Okay, yes, I can do that. So it's called Little Scarface. And I first learnt to tell it because it was told to me as a version of Cinderella. Now, I don't think it is a version of Cinderella, and you'll see why. But that might be why, or part of the reason why it suddenly changed for me. But it goes like this. There was a little girl who lived in a village, and her mother had died and left her, her two bigger sisters, and the father alone. And the father loved all three daughters equally, but he had to be away from home a lot, and when he was away, there was nobody to look after them. So the older two, Taki and Chepi, they had to look after their little sister, and they didn't like doing that job, and they were cruel to her. As she grew, they made her do lots of the work. And even when she was still very little, one day Chepi pushed her into the fire. And when her father came home and asked how she'd got these terrible burns all over her body, Chepi said, "Oh, she's so clumsy. She stumbled, she tripped and fell into the fire, but I rescued her, I got her out." And so Chepi was praised, and the little girl was left terribly scarred. And one day Taki poured a kettle of boiling water over her head. And again, when the father came home, he asked how her face had become so terribly scarred. And Taki said, "Oh, she's so clumsy. She was pouring the tea and the water went everywhere, but I rescued her and I helped her." So Taki got all the praise. And the little girl, by the time she was grown, had forgotten her name because her sisters just called her Little Scarface or Clumsy Scarface. So when the three girls were grown up and the father had died, Clumsy Scarface did all of the work for her two sisters, who lived like daughters of the chief. She went into the village and she collected the water, and she, one day as she was doing her chores, she heard the other women around the well talking about Strong Wind the Invisible. Strong Wind the Invisible is coming to town. Strong Wind the Invisible is looking for a wife. So Clumsy Scarface was curious. She went a little closer to the other women. She didn't usually show her face or talk to them, but she was curious. She said, "Who is Strong Wind the Invisible?" And they laughed at her. "Well, he's nothing to do with you, Clumsy Scarface. Strong Wind the Invisible is a great warrior chief with an amazing power. He can make himself invisible, and he is looking for a wife. But he has said that he will not marry anybody who cannot see him. And even now as we speak, there are women lining up at the beach to speak to his sister, Gentle Breeze. And Gentle Breeze is going to see who is worthy to marry Strong Wind the Invisible." So Little Scarface shrugged, and she took the water and she went home. By the time she got home, she found it was true. Chepi and Taki were in a flurry, getting themselves ready, putting on their best clothes, arguing over who was going to get to go and marry Strong Wind the Invisible. After all, it could only be one of them, and they were both absolutely sure that they would be the ones he would choose. And in the end, it was decided that Taki, as the oldest one, should be allowed to get married first. So Chepi sat down and sulked. Taki took herself off to the beach. And there was a line of women, but Taki elbowed her way to the front. And she said to Gentle Breeze, "Here I am. I am your brother's new wife." Well, Gentle Breeze looked her up and down. And then she said, "Do you see my brother returning from the hunt?" Taki looked across, and she squinted at where Gentle Breeze was pointing, where the forest came down to meet the sea, but she couldn't see anything. Of course she wasn't going to let on that she couldn't see anything. So she said, "Yes, of course, there he is. He's right there. I can see him clear as day. Can I marry him now?" Gentle Breeze said, "With what is he pulling his sled? Well, Taki couldn't see anything, so she had to think. At this point, I usually ask the audience, what's he pulling his sled with?
Dog.
A dog, right. He's pulling his sled with a dog. There we are, I can see. Gentle Breeze said, you cannot see my brother. He is not for you. And so Taki had to go home. And then it was Chapey's turn. She came out, she saw the line of women, she elbowed her way to the front, she marched straight up to Gentle Breeze. Here I am your brother's new wife. So Gentle Breeze said, can you see him returning from the hunt? And Chapey squinted and she looked and she couldn't see anything, but she wasn't going to let on that she couldn't see him. Yes, of course I can see him. There he is, clear as day. I can see him. He looks great. Gentle Breeze said, with what is he pulling his sled? And Chapey said,
elephant.
An elephant. Brilliant. I've never had an elephant before. Well done. An elephant. He's pulling his sled with an elephant. Isn't that great and unusual? Gentle Breeze said, yeah, you can't see my brother. He is not for you. So Chapey had to go home. And then Chapey and Taki made life even worse for little Scarface because they had been scorned, and they blamed it all on her. They said, you must have swept the floor so much that it made our eyes red and puffy and ugly, or you didn't wash our clothes properly. And they both gave beatings to go with their blame, and by the end of the day, little Scarface had just absolutely had enough. She thought to herself, there's no way that I could marry Strongwind the Invisible. Of course I couldn't. If he doesn't want Chapey or Taki, he doesn't want a scarred person like me. But perhaps if he's a good warrior and a good chief, he might be able to help my situation. He might just be able to help me because I can't last in this house anymore. And so she waited for her two sisters to be asleep and she crept out and she went to the beach to see if Gentle Breeze was still there. And she was. The moon was over the water and the women were drifting away one by one until eventually there was nobody left. So Clumsy Scarface went up to Gentle Breeze and she said, excuse me? And Gentle Breeze said, oh, hello. Can you see my brother returning from the hunt? She said, no, it's not that. I don't need to. It's just, I was wondering if perhaps maybe... And then her words tailed off. She just had no idea what to say. She said, I'm sorry for wasting your time. Gentle Breeze said, no, look, can you see him returning from the hunt? So little Scarface had a look. But as she looked along the water, her last hope fell away. There was nothing there. She said to Gentle Breeze, I'm so sorry. I can't see him. I'm sorry. And she turned to go. Then Gentle Breeze put a hand on her shoulder and said, hang on a moment. Just look again. Do you see him? Clumsy Scarface looked again. And she said, yes, I can see him. He's magnificent. So Gentle Breeze said, with what is he pulling his sled? And Clumsy Scarface said, he's pulling his sled with the Milky Way. Gentle Breeze said, and with what is his bow strung? His bow is strung with a rainbow. He's magnificent. And then Strongwind the Invisible approached. And as he came over to them, he said, I have been waiting for a woman who would tell the truth. And here you are. Clumsy Scarface said, I have nothing to offer you. I don't even know my own name. And Strongwind replied, your name is Honesty. Will you marry me? So Clumsy Scarface said, now that I've seen you, I never want to look away. And Gentle Breeze joined their hands, and the moonlit sand was witness. There you go.
Amazing. It strikes me listening to you that we are missing something in our culture, that we don't, there's not enough of older people telling stories to younger people. Just before we started recording, I told you about when I was a child and my parents would leave us at a older woman's house on Friday evenings. She would tell us stories from the Bible using a little felt board and little pictures of men and women she put onto the board. And we had to use our imagination because these pictures, you know, there's only so much that they said. But that struck, you know, that embedded those stories in me at a young age. And it was a great act of service from the woman. But of course, for centuries, particularly before we had screens, people were doing this all the time. They were telling stories in the evenings and pubs and around fires. We still tell stories through film and through, to some extent, through Netflix series. And Jonathan Haidt, the psychologist, makes the point that at least that's a lot better than, you know, 5-second reels on your phone. But yeah, do you think we're really missing something when we're so addicted to, you know, whatever's on Instagram?
We've definitely lost the art of the long form story, haven't we? That, which is really sad. I think that we still tell each other stories. I think humans always have and always will tell each other stories, even just about, you know, what's happened in our day, or the, you know, funny thing that happened to me last Thursday type of stories. We still do those. But yes, we've lost the stories of our families a lot, I think. I always tell my children about the, you know, things that my grandparents did in the war in the Channel Islands. They lived in the Channel Islands. And so that's, you know, because that's an important part of our family history. I'm not sure that everybody still does that kind of thing. And we've lost lots of cultural stories. Yeah.
And a lot of time the stories we tell each other are through WhatsApp and such broken, you know, this has happened rather than telling the full thing. Yeah.
I think we've stopped telling even obvious fairy tales to children. I've experienced a bit of that as a storyteller, that I used to be able to give them refrains and they would respond, that they would already know that if I said, little pig, let me come in, they would all, that, you know, most of them, the majority of them would go, not by the hairs on my chin, you know, they'd heard the story. That's not the case anymore. I'm not sure how that's happened, but I imagine YouTube is the answer. Just people not telling those stories in those ways anymore. That even if they're familiar with the Three Little Pigs, perhaps they've seen it on the screen and not actually heard the story with the refrain the way that it used to be told.
Perhaps parents aren't reading to their kids as much as previously as well. Yeah. Yeah, brilliant. So we're going to take another break. We'll be back in a few minutes. So I'm thinking again about this Native American story that you have worked with and developed. So why is it that this story points to the Christian message? Why do we find a story presumably that has been developed without much contact with the explicit Christian message? Why do we find traces of the Christian message in it, do you think?
Yeah, and in stories all over the world, from everywhere, from every age, from before Christianity, from in the Greek myths and so on, everywhere. I think that it all has to do with what we're told in Psalm 19, where it says that the heavens declare the glory of God. And in that psalm, you've got at the beginning of the psalm this image of the sun racing across the sky and the stars, everything in the heavens, declaring God's glory. And then at the end of the psalm, you've got a list of things about God's law. And so by the time you get to the end of the psalm, you realize that the whole thing is a metaphor and that God's law is like the sun, because it's everywhere and you can't get away from it and its light shines. But within that psalm, there's this idea that the whole of creation is designed to tell God's story, to just declare without a voice the glory of God. And so It does. So it does in the seasons, in the regrowth of the plants, in everything that we've always known since prehistory. The gospel is tucked away in creation itself. So we shouldn't be at all surprised if humans everywhere always have told stories as they look at the sun, as they look at the stars, as they look at the heavens, as they feel the wind, that they've told stories about their surroundings. We shouldn't be surprised if those stories have a flavor of the gospel in them, because creation was designed that way so that we can know God by looking at it.
I love that. I guess someone might push back and say, yes, but what about sin? So the Christian message claims that we are in a fallen world. So some, I guess you might call, I don't know, very, very people who are very reformed, have a very strong doctrine of original sin, of total depravity, might say that, but we can't expect to find sinners coming up with stories that are going to point us to divine reality. What we need is revelation to come in the form of the scripture to tell us what God is like. There's a bit of a debate amongst theologians, right? Revealed theology versus natural theology. Those who are more concerned about the sinful state we find ourselves in tend to emphasize more revealed theology rather than natural theology. Lewis obviously finds a middle way. How would you respond to an objection like that?
I would say, and so we do. That's what Psalm 19 is doing there in the book. It's explaining what creation is saying. And how otherwise can we fully understand the setting and the rising of the sun? It's interesting because we were talking about Orpheus and Eurydice right at the beginning of our conversation, and I was saying that the Greek myths diagnose the problem and that they don't provide a solution. But the sun sets and rises and sets and rises. So which end do we see ourselves? Do we see ourselves in the rising of the sun, or do we see that, in fact, our sun has set and we need it to rise again? How do we understand humanity itself? Those questions aren't just answered by what we see in creation. They are also answered by the other kinds of stories that we tell.
Yeah, so it's a complementary. These stories are fulfilled in scripture, yeah. Yeah. Do you know, we had, 15, 20 years ago, we had the New Atheist movement, and Dawkins and Hitchens and all there. This is sort of a hyper-rationalistic scientific approach to the world. And it feels like things have changed a bit. It feels like there's more openness to the arts, to what might be communicated through stories, to spirituality. There's in some sense there's more openness to pagan religion and even to the occult at the moment. So I'm just wondering if you've picked that up. I mean, do you think that people would be more attentive to what you and other Christian artists have to say now than they were 20 years ago?
Yes, I think they probably would. There's definitely, I think people are really hoping that the ancient things are true, or at least that the ancient things might have had something that tells us more about what it is to be a human than what we have now. And it's interesting that that's, you know, now in the age of AI encroaching everywhere and of the world in which we live being in the palms of our hands, being this robotic algorithm-fed, probably barely human content that we look at, I think people are thinking, what if they had something? What if we had something that's been lost?
Mm. Yeah, I like that idea of hoping. In some sense, people are giving themselves permission to explore this world. There was this real cultural pressure in the past saying, you know, whatever you believe, you have to give an argument for, you have to be able to prove through a scientific experiment. But now, as there's been a bit of a breakdown of that worldview, there's now people are giving themselves permission to explore. And well, on that note, I'm just, you know, you talk about fairy tales, and we have Martin Shaw coming on in a month's time as well. He'll be speaking to that theme as well. I'm just thinking then, these fairy tales, there's this openness in wider culture. How how might we think? I mean, can we make a more explicit link between the fairy tales that you tell and Martin and others tell and the Christian message itself?
I think it's interesting because you just mentioned human depravity. I think that's a really important one. I think we've lost the meaning of the word sin, and because of that, the word sin now causes a knee-jerk reaction in entirely the wrong direction. And because of that, it's almost impossible to have a conversation with somebody who doesn't... Well, it's almost impossible to have a conversation with anybody about it, actually, because you'll find you have two different meanings of the word. And understanding that human nature, imperfect human nature, cannot coexist with a holy God, I think is at the center of Christianity. The gospel makes no sense without it. And in a world where we've been told, you know, you're a good person, you're enough, so long as you just keep trying, then everything will be fine. And I think then we've lost the gospel, but we've lost the point of the gospel because we're no longer seeing ourselves in that very human, sinful way. And one thing that fairy tales almost always do is they have a prohibition. And G.K. Chesterton points that out in The Ethics of Elfland as well. He says, I think the way he puts it is, you may live with the princess so long as you never show her an onion. The prohibition rarely makes logical sense, but within the logic of the fairy tale, it makes absolute sense. And as soon as you hear the prohibition, you know that the hero is going to do the thing. And all of those instances in fairy tales are really interesting to look at because they speak to human nature on a macro and a micro level. So on the macro level, that obviously that resonates with Eden. You've got, you know, Pandora opening the box and all of the evils of the world flying out. It's like looking for a reason for evil. But if you think of the story of Bluebeard, this really gruesome story, where, and again, this exists in so many cultures. I'm saying Bluebeard because that's Grimm's fairy tales and people might know it. This exists all over the place. There's a West African version, there's a Jamaican version. The Bluebeard marries the girl and then he goes away and he gives her a bunch of keys. And he says, you can have anything in my house. You can open any door, but don't use this little key and open that particular door, or it will be the worse for you. So she's in this house and she can have anything, you know, all the treasure, everything. She can have big parties. What does she do? She goes straight to the door and she opens the door. And behind the door are his six previous wives that he's slaughtered, lying in a pool of blood. She's so shocked that she drops the key. And when she picks it up, it's stained with blood, but it's magic, a magic key, and she can't get the blood stain off. So he knows that she's opened the door. But if you think about it, even if he didn't know, he would know from the way she looked at him over breakfast the next morning, wouldn't he? She's done it now. She's seen. And there's that kind of knowledge of good and evil thing there, isn't there? I mean, obviously, Bluebeard is evil. He's not, you know, this is hardly a direct allegory. He's not in the place of God here with his prohibition. But the fact that she has seen, everything is suddenly not perfect. A life that could have been fine is not perfect because now she knows the thing. And that's very, what she knows is that evil exists. And we have to know that evil exists or we can't carry on the story and get the eventual rescue and defeat Bluebeard and get out of there. Otherwise he's going to kill her and then keep killing all of his wives. Yes, so we always do the prohibited thing. And all of us will always do the prohibited thing. So that's human nature. And it's interesting because that happens at the beginning of the fairy tale and then you spend the rest of the time trying to get your way out of it and undo the mistake. And then at the end, there's always a rescue. So I think in the fairy tale, there are two rules. We will always do the bad thing we will always be rescued. And that is the gospel. We will do the prohibited thing. We can't help it. It's our nature. It's what's expected. It will happen. The door will open. The blood will be there. You know, we'll show the princess an onion. Everything will fall apart. Human lives will be lost. But we will always be rescued. We will be rescued. There is a savior. God has sorted out that problem because he knows what we're like.
And you find when people hear that, they can identify, you know, they say, if that's what you're talking about, when you're talking about sin, you think it's almost universal that people can hear that and see it in themselves?
I hope so. As I say, the story that we're being told is you're a good person and you're fine. And as long as, you know, you have this certain level of goodness and you're not privately some kind of monster, then everything is fine and what you do is justified. And we justify ourselves. The truth of human nature is not that. The truth of human nature is sin and death. And we've already looked into the Greek myths with the death. And in the fairy tales, there is the sin. We will always do the prohibited thing. It is just a truth.
That's interesting. I remember somebody asking a question at a sort of an apologetics event saying, you know, I don't see myself as, I'm not a really bad person. I'm not a Hitler or whatever else. I haven't done awful things, but Christianity says that I have to believe that in some sense I'm a sinner. And she was struggling with that question. Could you link what you've just said to her question, her struggle with faith?
Yeah, it's what Paul says. I do what I don't want to do, and I'm paraphrasing Paul terribly here. Whatever I want to do, I don't do it. We will always make the mistake. But even if you look at your life and you think, well, comparatively, I'm all right. I haven't done any terribly evil deeds. The thing to understand is that sin is just another word for human, and humanity cannot coexist with an utterly holy God. It's like a chemical reaction. It's not a question of, I think so many people see God as having the ability to change this situation by changing his mind. And it's really important that just isn't true. God hasn't created a world where he's decided that humans can't get to him, but he could, if he wanted, just say, oh, actually, no, it's fine, I don't mind, come on in. When you read stories in the Bible about, there's that story where somebody touches the ark and just drops down dead, and people will read that and say, you know, That's awful. What a horrible judgmental God would strike him down. That's not, it's more like putting potassium into water and it goes, but it's never going to do anything other than go boom. You cannot have human nature and a holy God together until Jesus makes the way for that to happen. And that's the most important thing about the gospel, I think.
So much here. Let's talk a bit about metaphor. You work on metaphor, and this ties into what we've just been saying. But can you help us out? Like, what is metaphor? How might we understand it, and why is it important when we're thinking about these sort of big questions of life?
Yeah. So I've written two books, particularly on scriptural metaphor, called Image of the Invisible and Images of Grace. Scripture is full of metaphors. Metaphor is Greek for to carry a cross, which interestingly in Latin, the words transfer is exactly the same roots. So a metaphor is something that is carried across into our understanding, something that we cannot possibly understand because it is too big and too outside of our knowledge, is carried across into a concrete thing that we can see and understand. So Jesus' parables about the kingdom of heaven are examples of metaphors. He's giving us a way to understand the kingdom of heaven when he says, it is like a woman who takes yeast and puts it into bread. And so there's this one specific, that's a specific metaphor about how the kingdom of heaven kind of grows and pervades. But scripture is full of metaphors. And my first book, Images of God, was just all the scriptural metaphors for God. From the obvious ones you can think of, like shepherd and rock. And anchor, and then there's mother hen, and then, you know, then there's bread and light, and the I am sayings of Jesus are all metaphors. These are all ways that something we cannot understand gets taken across into our understanding. But the beautiful thing about that is that Jesus is therefore himself a kind of metaphor, not because he is metaphorical, but because he is heaven carried across into our understanding, becoming flesh. He is the image of the invisible God.
Yeah. And I mean, some would even, I think people like Ian McGilchrist would even go as far as to say that all language is metaphorical. What is it? Wittgenstein says that when you dig deep and you hit bedrock and your spade is turned, what you've hit is metaphor. There, what do you think of that?
Yeah, it is. It is a word. Every word is a metaphor. You're trying to express something. I mean, as a poet, I know this. You just are trying to make your expressions, your words, get more and more and more precise, tighter and tighter and tighter, until you are closer and closer and closer to the completely indescribable emotion you are trying to describe.
Yeah, again, we talked too much about Lewis, but Lewis gives this example where he takes one piece of prose and he says, okay, let's get rid of the metaphorical language. But he just makes the point, whatever you replace with it, you know, is going to be similarly metaphorical, and we don't, a lot of the time we're not aware of that.
Yeah. So Psalm 19 has offered us a metaphor. It's with the sun crossing the sky, that is like God's law, because it is everywhere. Nothing can hide from its heat. You can't hide away from God's law. It's very obvious. You can see it. Thus, the heavens, the sun, is like the law of God. That's a metaphor. But the Bible also offers us lots of metaphors for the gospel, metaphors for what Jesus has done. I think we would call them atonement theories, but they're metaphors. They're images, because we will never fully be able to grasp or understand the way, the mechanism by which we are saved. But throughout the Bible, we have been shown sacrifice, we've been shown ransom, we've been shown, you know, exchange, and we've been shown the Passover. And so more and more, as we come to it, we begin to understand what has happened. All of those, though, are metaphors.
Yeah, a really interesting point, that maybe some of these theories like penal substitution theory or ransom theory, Anselm satisfaction theory, that these are theories that help us try to understand, but you get a better understanding perhaps by drawing on metaphor itself. You know, if you tell Lewis's story about Aslan and Edmund and the witch, you're not spelling out exactly how it works, but do you think you're giving people a better intuitive insight into what's going on at the cross?
You're giving them a handhold into it. You're providing something that they can grasp, literally grasp. A metaphor takes something abstract and makes it concrete. And so when we grasp with our understanding, it's because we've been given this picture that is concrete, something that we can see and imagine, and that then, you know, by that we can understand.
And how has this all worked out for you and your vocation? What are you trying to do? You obviously told us about how for years you've been telling stories. So what is it you're trying to do then? What are you trying to make sense of as you tell the stories? And you're also, we haven't talked as much anywhere near about poetry. You're also a poet as well.
Yes, and it's all much of a muchness. Right. So I suppose with what I'm trying to do, it's just about expression and trying to put these ideas out into the world, I suppose. Half the time I'm trying to work it out for myself.
Right.
And then perhaps only people exactly like me will understand it and grasp it. But, you know, then it's still worth doing. If it's only people exactly like me who will suddenly go, ah.
But no, but I think people who aren't like you, they need it. They need to hear it. We need our poets and storytellers to open up these realms of reality, or not realms of reality, but these ways of understanding those realms of reality that they're so familiar with from other ways of understanding, like hearing sermons and whatever else. So looking ahead, what's on the horizon for you, to use a metaphor, with your work?
I hope to do more with the poetry. Certainly want to keep writing poems and begin to get them out into the world, because some of my poems are in my books, but I've never produced an actual book of poetry. So that's a possible next thing. But it's all, I go where God puts me and I tell some stories and I see what happens. And yes, when an idea comes to me, then I'll try to get it out into the world as much as I can.
Wonderful. We are so glad and grateful that God has put you on this table talking to us today, because it's been such a rich conversation. Again, a lot of our guests are, I guess, a bit more on the rational side of apologetics. So it's been so rich hearing from you. But as Ian McGilchrist, one of our previous guests, he said, you know, you've got rationality, which is be this sort of narrow understanding of logic, whereas reason, he has this picture of reason that the ancients had, that includes the arts, and it's only through that holistic approach to reality that we can really grasp it in its fullness. And what you've offered to us has been so helpful in that regard. So thanks for joining
us. Thank you.
And to our viewers and listeners, thank you again, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Take care.